everyone. Welcome to Thomas and the Bible, episode 17. Coincidentally, we are on Exodus chapter 17. That must mean there's a God. It's the only explanation. That must be it. This one is another little late one. If you're, I don't know if anybody's listening, like, in real time. But if you are, sorry, this one's late. If not, then it's not late, and I was just pretending. Okay, so let's get right into it. Like I said, chapter 17, episode 17. I don't know if that'll ever happen again. Unless later on chapter, like, 40, we're on... Yeah, I don't know. Okay, and all the congregation of the children of Israel journeyed from the wilderness of Sin after their journeys, according to the commandment of the Lord, and pitched in Rephidim. And there was no water for the people to drink. Wherefore the people did chide with Moses, and said, "Give us water that we may drink." And Moses said unto them, "Why chide ye with me? Wherefore do ye tempt the Lord?" And I have to ask, why are these freaking morons the chosen people of God? They are absolutely worse than the Egyptians. Yet God has decided to save them all and murder all of the Egyptians. This is like, if you don't remember, God murdered all of Egypt in the last couple chapters. This is like the third time these freaking whiners are already questioning Moses and God, who is directly helping them and who has saved them like 20 times. These people are idiots, and they aren't even, it's not like they're respectful of God or something, you know, like they don't have any qualities. They're just, they happen to be the chosen people of the earth for no reason. How do people not see through this? How do people not understand that this is something these people made up? These aren't special people. These are totally normal people. There's nothing special about them. They just, their God somehow caught on. They did something right with that, you know? And the people thirsted there for water, and the people murmured against Moses. See, they're already murmuring against him. I have to say, if this were real and I was there, you know, if all this were actually happening, which obviously it didn't, but if it were, I would have been hanging on Moses' every word and would have just been like, what do we do? Hey, I would have said, hey, Moses, we're a little short on water. You know, what's your plan? I'm sure you have a plan. I'm sure God has a plan because he's God and he saved us the whole time. So just letting you know, though, just giving you the heads up. We're a little short. That's all. That's all. There'd be no, hey, why don't we have a, you know, it's stupid. Wherefore is this that thou hast brought us out up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our cattle with thirst? And Moses cried unto the Lord, saying, what shall I do unto this people? They be almost ready to stone me. Again, they're so quick to turn on him. It's unbelievable. You know what, though? I have to say, if you think about this in terms of reality and how it might have actually happened, because I'm sure it's not just 100% fabricated. I'm sure there's some sort of, you know, event that sort of was like, you know, and they just embellished on it, something like that. If you think about it, it might make sense that they would do this because Moses is obviously just making all this shit up from day one. He's just making all, Moses has sort of invented this God. I don't know if he invented it or if he just took it from those who had already invented it and modified it or whatever he did. We know that there is no God, so we know he's not talking to God, but he's probably pretending that he's talking to God. And I bet he's at another point here where he doesn't have any answers and the people are getting restless and saying like, what do we do? You know? And he's like, God will, you know, like what can he say really? And I think from that perspective, it sort of makes sense. But if you take the point of view that God is real, then none of these events make any sense. If this was all true, it's stupid and obviously false, if that makes sense, because the people are just ridiculously stupid or something. It's not, so either they should not be the chosen people, which is true, or they're just incredibly stupid and God chose them anyway. And in that case, I don't like God. There, I said it. I hate God. This God is an idiot. He's an idiot. Good thing he's not real. And the Lord said unto Moses, Go on before the people, and take with thee of the elders of Israel, and thy rod, wherewith thou smotest the river, take in thine hand, and go. Behold, I will stand before thee there upon the rock in Horeb, and thou shalt smite the rock, and there shall come water out of it, that the people may drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. And he called the name of the place Massah and Meribah, because of the two names? Isn't one name enough? Because of the chiding of the children of Israel, and because they tempted the Lord, saying, Is the Lord among us or not? Then came Amalek, and fought with Israel and Rephidim. Then came Amalek. So God told Moses to go with the people and do something about the water. But then there's this guy, more importantly, there's this guy, Amalek, who we're supposed to believe just came out of absolutely nowhere and started fighting them. That's really what it says. Like, it's talking about a completely different thing. It said, the Lord is, you know, he named it Meribah and Massah, blah, blah, blah. And then just out of the blue, it says, Then came Amalek and fought with Israel. So I had to look this up. I had to look up some notes about it because it made no sense. Who the hell is this guy and what is he doing? And what it says is, First, my questions were, who is this guy? How in the world did he find them? And what is his motivation to just start fighting them? Those were my questions. And I looked it up, and it turns out Amalek is the son of Eliphaz. So if that doesn't answer it, I guess I'll explain further. Eliphaz is the son of Esau. Now, you might vaguely remember Esau. I know I vaguely remember Esau. The notes I read says that this attack came without any provocation because Esau hated Jacob's birthright. So, at first I'm like, I guess that kind of makes sense. But then let's actually think about it. So Esau hated Jacob so much that not even Esau's son, but Esau's son's son decides he's finally had enough. And so he says to his people, I heard all the Israelites are out in the forest somewhere. And I don't know, are you guys doing anything right now, everybody? Whatever you're doing, just drop it, because we should just go kill all the Israelites, okay? All right. Like, so that's what happened? And somehow they found him, too. These Israelites have been wandering for 40 years in the wilderness. I mean, if they didn't know where they were, I'm sorry, if they knew where they were, they wouldn't be wandering for 40 years. And if they didn't know where they were, the Amalekites wouldn't have found them. This is just an absolute mystery. So, if that's not strange enough, there's more. Now, remember, Esau and Jacob, those were the twins, and there's all that birthright stuff where the one stole the other's birthright, sold it to him for a pot of soup, lentils or whatever. Do you remember that? I paused for reply. No? Well, yeah, that's what happened. And on the surface, you think, Esau hated Jacob for that because of his birthright. But then I actually remembered, they had this tearful reunion where they hugged each other. And remember, it was after Jacob was, quote-unquote, wrestling the, quote-unquote, angel, a.k.a. Gay rent boy, do you remember that? Well, after that, if you remember, they reunited and they were crying and they were hugging and everything was a-okay between Esau and Jacob. Yet we are supposed to believe that Esau was so mad at Jacob somehow that Esau's grandson decided to just attack them out of nowhere. So I think I have an intuition about this. I honestly haven't read ahead except for the chapters that I'm doing today, obviously. But I do know a little bit about this because I've heard people talk about it, the Amalekites. I don't know if you do too. Try not to give too much away. But keep this little bit in the back of your mind because I'm 99.9% plus about 100%. So 199.9% positive that this was all made up, this part here, in order to justify something that's going to happen later. So keep that in the back of your mind. Sorry, that was a long bit of rant. Okay, let's go on. And Moses said unto Joshua, choose us out men and go out and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with a rod of God in mine hand. And Joshua did as Moses had said to him, and fought with Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. And it came to pass, when Moses held up his hand, that Israel prevailed. And when he let down his hand, Amalek prevailed, or Amalek, or whatever. So, I don't know if you follow that. They're fighting. When Moses holds up his hand, Moses and team are winning. When he lowers his hand, Amalek is winning. So I'm sure at first there's this whole, like, in every movie, there's this whole discovery where he's like, he's holding up his hands and then he's lowering them. He's timing it, like, to see what happens with the battle and all that. Sort of a ridiculous image. Moving on. But Moses' hands were heavy from holding him up. And they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat thereon. And Aaron and Hur stayed up his hands, the one on the one side and the other on the other side. And his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. This is even more hilarious. So Joshua's fighting, right? And Joshua's job is to have a sword and do battle. Moses' job is to hold up his hands. And Moses is having trouble doing his part. Like, I imagine Joshua was like, Moses, why the hell can't you keep up your arms? Excuse me. This is life and death. I'm out here freaking fighting these people with swords, and you can't just hold your arms up for a little bit longer? Like, how pissed would you have been? And this is such a funny image. So the other people hold his arms up. Like, somehow that follows the rules. So it's not Moses. This is going to get a little abstract, but if there's any sense to be made of this, it would be that Moses is holding up his hand. It's the fact that he's doing it and is giving his power to his people, sort of, in that act. But no, it's not that he's doing it. It's that merely the position of his hand is somehow doing something. Because if someone else holds up his hand, then it still works. Like, I imagine if someone cut off his arms and, like, held him up, then it would still... It seems like it. I don't know why not. Just stupid rules that make no sense. And Joshua discomfited Amalek and his people with the edge of his sword. I love that. He discomfited them with his sword. And the Lord said unto Moses, write this for a memorial in a book, and rehearse it in the ears of Joshua, for I will utterly put out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. A little foreshadowing. And Moses built an altar and called the name of it Jehovah Nissi. For he said, because the Lord hath sworn that the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. I'm telling you, this whole little thing was made up to justify some terrible crap that's going to happen later. We'll see. All right, next chapter. When Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard of all that God had done for Moses and for Israel, his people, and that the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt, then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Zipporah, Moses' wife, after he had sent her back, and her two sons, of which the name of the one was Jena Gershom, for he said, I have been an alien in a strange land, and the name of the other was Eliezer. For the God of my father, he said, was mine help, and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, came with his sons and his wife unto Moses in the wilderness, where he encamped at the Mount of God. And he knew right where to find him, apparently. I guess I guess Moses had sent his wife back. I don't know. He got tired of her or something. He sent his wife back to his wife's father. And his wife's father was like, oh, I want to go join Moses. He sounds pretty cool, and God's done a lot for him. So I guess when Moses sent his wife away, she said, honey, how am I going to find you again? Will you just be here, I guess? And Moses was like, yep. Well, we've been wandering in a tight circle for 40 years. I don't see any reason to change up now. So, yeah, we'll be here. Just, head back when you want to. Again, they wandered for 40 years in the wilderness. I don't understand. So that means they actually just stood in the same place for 40 years. It must, because all these people are just able to find him easily. I don't get it. 40 years. And he said unto Moses, I, thy father-in-law, Jethro, am come unto thee, and thy wife, and her two sons with her. And Moses went out to meet his father-in-law, and did obeisance, and kissed him. And they asked each other of their welfare. And they came into the tent. And Moses told his father-in-law all that the Lord had done unto Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake, and all the travail that had come upon them by the way, and how the Lord delivered them. And Jethro rejoiced for all the goodness which the Lord had done to Israel, whom he had delivered out of the hand of the Egyptians. And Jethro said, Blessed be the Lord, who hath delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians, and out of the hand of Pharaoh, who hath delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all gods, for in the thing wherein they dealt proudly he was above them. Greater than all gods. Again, I'm telling you, it's not that they only believe in one God, it's that they think they have found the most powerful God. Listen to that quote again. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all gods. Now, you can sort of, well, you can, and people do, religious people do, overanalyze the crap out of this book. And they, of course, many, just as a side note, many brilliant minds who unfortunately believed in God for psychological reasons or something, or just, there's a number of things that go into it. But anyway, many brilliant minds have gone through this stupid book and invented all kinds of different ways to tie together these loose ends and to make things fit together. Just imagine, no book has been more studied, I'm sure, than this one. I mean, mind after mind after mind has gone through it and probably found ways to bend the words, to tie everything together, to make it make sense. But think about it. It's a perfect book written by God. You shouldn't have to do that. I ought to be able to read it, and everything ought to be just infinitely clear to me. But no, now I know that the Lord is greater than all gods. Well, that tells me that there's more than one God. That's what that tells me. Now, that it shouldn't say that. That's simple as that. There's no reason for the Bible to say that. If you want to say, well, it doesn't mean gods. It means that figuratively, you know, if you want to make excuses for it, you can. But you have to do that on almost every verse. And doesn't that seem wrong to you? It's a perfect book. It should be the best thing anyone's ever read. Not something that you have to frequently make excuses for. And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and sacrifices for God. And Aaron came, and all the elders of Israel, to eat bread with Moses' father-in-law before God. And I have to read, okay, so all they're doing is offering. Nothing's really happening right now. They're making a burnt offering. But I have to tell you guys, I go through these Bible notes to try to make sure I'm getting everything out of this, you know? So really, I'm quite fair about this. I read a lot of perspectives on it. But anyway, that's not the point. I read this line. This is a quote from these notes. It's about this line with the burnt offering. It says, they ate in the place, this is quote, they ate in the place where the sacrifice was offered, for part was burnt and the rest eaten, end quote. And I just found that so funny. Like, it just put an image into my mind. Like, what happened was Jethro, the guy who's doing this, he was like cooking dinner for everyone, and he's like, Shit, I burned dinner again. Damn it. Oh, they are not going to be happy about this. Okay. Hey, everyone. Okay, yeah, I'm done with dinner. There's a bit of a burnt part there on the outside and all that. Yeah, that's an offering to God is what that is. Obviously. Duh. So anything that's sort of edible, though, that you find, that's not an offering to God. And go ahead and eat that. But the burnt, all the burnt stuff, I wanted to just make a burnt offering to God. So that's what that is. Okay? So that's what popped into my mind when I read that line, that weird line. And it came to pass on the morrow that Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood by Moses from the morning unto the evening. And this is clear that Moses is making all this up, obviously, because people are asking him different questions. And sorry, this just in the back of my mind, I'm keeping like what the reality of this book would be, separate from what it's actually saying. And what I think is happening here is that Moses is obviously making all this up. So people are just asking him different stuff about God, and he's like, well, okay, I think that, you know, he's just pulling it out of his hat the whole time. He's coming up with any answers he can come up with. And when Moses' father-in-law saw all that he did to the people, he said, what is this thing that thou doest to the people? Why sittest thou by thyself alone, and all the people stand by thee from morning unto even? And Moses said unto his father-in-law, because the people come unto me to inquire of God. When they have a matter, they come unto me, and I judge between one and another, and I do make them know the statutes of God and his laws. I didn't know he had statutes and laws. Hasn't mentioned anything about that. And Moses' father-in-law said unto him, the thing that thou doest is not good. Thou wilt surely wear away, both thou and this people that is with thee, for this thing is too heavy for thee. Thou art not able to perform it thyself alone. Hearken now unto my voice. I will give thee counsel, and God shall be with thee. Be thou for the people to Godward, that thou mayest bring the causes unto God. And thou shalt teach them ordinances and laws, and shalt shew them the way wherein they must walk, and the work that they must do. So what's happened here is, like I said, people just come to, I guess Moses sits in like a lawn chair, and people just come and ask him like, hey, I'm thinking about killing a guy. What does God have to say on that? You know, and then Moses sort of makes up whatever he thinks God says. And then his, Moses' father-in-law comes and says, why are you doing this? There's only one of you. You're going to get burnt out. Someday you're going to die. This is not, you know, very tenable. You need to come up with a better way. That's what he's saying. You need to come up with a better way. Teach more people what you know is what the father-in-law is saying. Moreover, thou shalt provide out of all the people able men, such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and place such over them to be rulers of thousands and rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties and rulers of tens. And the whole time. So the father-in-law is giving all this advice, and Moses is probably murmuring under his breath like, oh, shut up, shut up, shut up. The reason I haven't taught them about God's law is because I'm making this up as I go along. Don't ruin this one for me, father-in-law, damn it. That's probably what he's thinking. And let them judge the people at all seasons, and it shall be that every great matter they shall bring unto thee, but every small matter they shall judge. So it shall be easier for thyself, and they shall bear the burden with thee. If thou shalt do this thing, and God command thee so, then thou shalt be able to endure, and all this people shall also go into their place in peace. So what he's telling him is train more people, and small things, those people, you know, micromanage, or delegate rather, delegate. Small things those people will be able to figure out, but bigger things they can talk to you. That's all I say. So Moses hearkened to the voice of his father and did all that he said. He probably said, Moses probably said, thank you for all that great advice, asshole. That's probably what he said, because he had a perfect plan. He was the sole authority. He'd just make it up anytime anyone asked him to do something. But now, no. It's blown. And Moses chose able men out of all Israel and made them heads over the people, rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, and rulers of tens. And I just think about like what those 10 people must have thought. You have all kinds of rulers. You got Moses. He's the king. Then you got rulers of thousands. You know, those are pretty high up too. Then you got rulers of hundreds, little lower, maybe like your everyday priest, you know, preaches to like 100 people. And then you have rulers of 50, even lower. And then you have rulers of 10. So the 9 other people or whatever, the 10 people in that group, must have just been like, you know, they're like the ones waiting to get picked, you know, at recess for the team. You know, they're like, they're the last people. No one's picked them. And they're like, I don't get it. Why is everybody else is ruling somebody? I'm just sitting here. So I have to be ruled. That's all I get to do. And they judged the people at all seasons, the hard causes they brought unto Moses, but every small matter they judged themselves. And Moses let his father-in-law depart, and he went his way into his own land. End of chapter 18. On to the next chapter. So I forgot to tell you guys at the beginning of this episode. This is the Ten Commandments episode. So it's the last chapter, so not quite yet. But that's a pretty big deal. So this one I'm going to try to hurry through to leave maximum time for the Ten Commandments. Because it's kind of a big deal. People know the Ten Commandments. That's all I'm saying. In the third month, when the children of Israel were gone forth out of the land of Egypt, the same day they came into the wilderness of Sinai. For they were departed from Rephidim, and were come to the desert of Sinai, and had pitched in the wilderness, and there Israel camped out before the mount. And Moses went up unto God, and the Lord called unto him of the mountain, saying, Thus shalt thou say to the house of Jacob, and tell the children of Israel, Ye have seen what I did unto the Egyptians, and how I bare you on eagles' wings, and brought you unto myself. Now therefore, if ye will obey my voice indeed, and keep my covenant, then ye shall be a peculiar treasure unto me above all people, for the earth is mine, mine. And ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests, and a holy nation. These are the words which thou shalt speak unto the children of Israel. And Moses came and called for the elders of the people, and laid before their faces all these words which the Lord commanded him. And all the people answered together and said, All that the Lord hath spoken we will do. And Moses has them eating right out of his palm. And Moses returned the words of the people unto the Lord. Is that necessary? So Moses is a go-between? Like, I understand why Moses might need to take the Lord's word to people. But why does he have to take the people's word to the Lord? The Lord knows. Kind of weird. And the Lord said unto Moses, Lo, I come unto thee in a thick cloud, like the smoke monster from Lost, that the people may hear when I speak with thee, and believe thee forever. And Moses told the words of the people unto the Lord. And the Lord said unto Moses, Go unto the people, and sanctify them today and tomorrow, and let them wash their clothes. And be ready against the third day, for the third day the Lord will come down in the sight of all the people upon Mount Sinai. And thou shalt set bounds unto the people round about, saying, Take heed to yourselves, that ye go not up into the mount, or touch the border of it. Whosoever toucheth the mount shall be surely put to death. So that's weird. They're at Mount Sinai, basically. No one can go up Mount Sinai except Moses, I guess, and maybe Moses' family. And I think, okay, again, that side reality in the back of my mind this whole time. I think what's happening here is Moses is starting to get a little overwhelmed. So he's had all these questions. He's had trouble keeping his story straight. He's trying to teach people this law he's making up. So I think he's like setting them up to sort of get away for a bit and like think about it. You know, he's like, I need to go. You know, he's overwhelmed. He's like, oh, I can't answer all these questions. Hey, everyone. God just called, texted me. I follow God on Twitter. I need to go up to this mountain because he's going to talk to me for, I don't know, 3 days or so. Taking a little me time, a little me and God time. Also, if you come up the mountain, you'll be killed. That's just one thing I got to tell you guys. I'll see you guys in a few days. And again, death to whoever follows me. So it seems pretty clear to me that he's trying to sort of, you know, get some space to do some thinking. There shall not be an hand to touch it, but he shall surely be stoned or shot through, whether it be beast or man, it shall not live. When the trumpet soundeth long, they shall come up to the mount. So they can't even touch the mountain or the mount. Otherwise, they're dead. They'll be shot or stoned. Trifle unnecessary, methinks. And Moses went down from the mount unto the people and sanctified the people, and they washed their clothes. Good, they stunk. And he said unto the people, be ready against the third day. Come not at your wives. Come not at your wives. So they're not allowed to come at their wives for 3 days. And I imagine there's probably one guy who got caught, and he's like, look, I'm not coming at my wife. I'm coming with her. That's the excuse I would have given anyway. And it came to pass on the third day in the morning that there were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud upon the mount. Smoke monster from Lost. And the voice of the trumpet exceeding loud, so that all the people that was in the land trembled, and in the camp trembled. And Moses brought forth the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at nether part of the mount. And Mount Sinai was altogether on a smoke, because the Lord descended upon it in fire, and the smoke thereof ascended as the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mount quaked greatly. And when the voice of the trumpet sounded long and waxed louder and louder, Moses spake, and God answered him by a voice. And the Lord came down upon Mount Sinai at the top of the mount, and the Lord called Moses up to the top of the mount, and Moses went up. Yeah, Moses was like, okay, hey guys, I'm going to go up here, talk to God for a bit. Now, again, no one come up here. Remember, you'll be killed if you cross that line I made, or if you even touch it, you'll be killed. So I'm going to go up here, and then he goes up there, and he's like, damn it, Moses, think, Moses, what am I going to do? What am I going to tell these people? I'm going to make up something. I need some laws. I need some, you know, some tangible thing to give them. You know, that's what he's doing up there. And the Lord said unto Moses, go down, charge the people, lest they break through unto the Lord to gaze, and many of them perish. Sorry, I gotta point this out real quick. The Lord said they can't look at the mountain or go up the mountain, otherwise they'll die. And then the Lord's telling Moses, hey, look, you better tell these people not to come up the mountain, because I don't want them to die. You know, like it's out of the Lord's control. Like, he has to kill him if they come up the mount? Like, how about just a stern warning? Why do you have to kill people who... Ugh, it's so stupid. And the priest... and let the priests also, which come near the Lord, sanctify themselves, lest the Lord break forth upon them. And Moses said unto the Lord, the people cannot come up to Mount Sinai, for thou charged us, saying, set bounds about the mount, and sanctify it. And the Lord said unto him, away, get thee down, and thou shalt come up, thou and Aaron with thee, but let not the priests and the people break through to come up unto the Lord, lest he break forth upon them. So he's like, hold me back, keep me away from these people, I might kill them, I'm afraid of what I might do, the Lord says, because he's so out of control, apparently. So Moses went down unto the people and spake unto them. And that's the end of the chapter, and he, guess what Moses spake unto them? He spake the Ten Commandments, and I can't wait to get to it, so on to the next chapter. Oh, well, this is a chapter that everyone knows, or at least knows about. We've come to the Ten Commandments, everyone. I'm excited, but also, this is going to be a lot to cover. And keep in mind, so one thing I want you guys to keep in mind, that these are supposedly the direct word of God as how we need to act to be moral people. This is it. This is God telling us what we need to do. Verse 1. Chapter 20 of Exodus. And God spake all these words, saying, I am the Lord thy God, which have brought thee, again, reminding us, which have brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. So, the first freaking commandment is not thou shalt not kill, or thou shalt not have slaves, or thou shalt not rape, or anything like that, no. It's the most important things humans could possibly do. The most important moral act is to make sure to not have any other gods but this one. So even before, you know, child rape, genocide, torture, any horrible thing you can think of, that's not as important as having no other god but this one. What a jealous, insecure piece of crap god this is supposed to be. This so-called god. Terrible. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them nor serve them, for I, the Lord, thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me. Ugh. He just goes out and admits that he punishes the third and fourth generation for things that people before that did. How unfair. That's so obviously unjust. Anyway, so this second commandment is sort of a compound one. In fact, there are two thou shalt nots in it. So I would make the argument there are actually 11 commandments. This compound one is first, thou shalt not make a graven image, and secondly, thou shalt not worship said graven image. So again, commandment two, we should finally be getting to thou shalt not kill or something like that. But no. More crap on how to not make God jealous. Also, if you read this language, doesn't it sound like we aren't allowed to draw like any pictures? Listen to this. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above. And if you stop there, then yeah, okay, he's saying don't draw him or whatever, you know, don't draw angels or don't make graven images of that. But it doesn't stop there. It goes on. Or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. So we can't, it's like, it sounds like we can't draw anything in the world. But maybe, I guess if you sort of figure that the next one is like a continuation of it, then it means you can't do that and worship it. Then maybe, you know, drawing a bird is okay, but as long as you don't draw it and worship it. So I guess you could get through that somehow. But then that means people, interestingly enough, it means people should not have any illustrations of God or of Jesus or of the Holy Spirit, although I'm not sure what an illustration of the Holy Spirit is. I don't think many people draw him. He's a little tough to draw. But that's not what I witness in the people I know who are religious. You see, in a lot of Christians and you know, the kind of religions that get really excited about God, they always have those big, like, pictures of Jesus. I've been in a church once where there was a big, like statue of Jesus coming out from the top upper wall near the ceiling in front of everybody with his arms open. It was so ridiculous looking. But we shouldn't have that. No one should have any of that. It's against the second commandment. And I read I read something about this. And one site said that people should really destroy any of these images they have in their church or in their homes because it goes against this commandment. And then they tried to justify the commandment. And they're like, yeah, how would you feel if instead of talking to you, someone made a wax statue of you and started talking to that instead? And I just thought it was like the funniest bit of logic. First of all, it's not that we're doing that because there is no God and or he's supposedly in the sky. So we're making something, you know, to sort of represent him. Because, you know, maybe we're visual people. We want to see something that we're worshiping, you know, that could be totally justified. So this idea that we're making a wax statue of him and talking to it instead of him is somehow insulting. But secondly, if you made the metaphor more accurate, it would be like, okay, I'm across the world. I've never seen someone who supposedly like my, I don't know, I guess the appropriate analogy would be somebody like your wife or your husband, because we're supposed to be that close with God, if you think about it. And if that person, say, who's across the sea, who's never seen you, who only gets to talk to you sort of one way, said, oh, hey, I drew a picture of you to sort of represent who I'm talking to because I just want to put a, you know, have something visual to go along with it. Would you say, oh, out of the question? First of all, it's a ridiculous scenario, which is how ridiculous this old God thing is. But secondly, like you'd be outraged at that. All right. That's fine, I guess. Whatever. Hopefully it looks good. All right, moving on. And shewing mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments. Oh, sorry, that was part of that last text. He's just saying he really punishes people who are mad at him through three or four generations, which is terribly unjust. And he is nice to people who love him. That's all he's saying. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless that taketh his name in vain. I like, so the third commandment, a famous one, don't take the Lord's name in vain. You hear that one all the time, and I say, God damn it all the time. God damn it, God damn it, God damn it, God damn it. Oh man, I'm going to hell. Oh no, I'm so scared. Also, I love the passive language on this one. It says, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless that taketh his name in vain. Like he's trying to change up the formula, you know, like it's getting a little too formulaic. For the Lord God will not hold him guiltless, like I will not think that you are not bad for doing this. That's essentially what he's saying. So in researching this one, I should try to get through it fast, but I uncovered an interesting bit of knowledge. God's name is actually Yahweh, and it's in the Old Testament at least. I'm not sure about the New Testament. But it's mentioned nearly 7,000 times in the original Hebrew version. But in almost every translation, Yahweh is replaced with the Lord or God or something like that. We've heard it a million times, the Lord or God or whatever. Think of Yahweh whenever you hear that, because that's what's in the original text. And this article I read says that the original commandment might have meant more literally, like, don't take the name Yahweh in vain, which would be funny because the very act of ridding the Bible of the name Yahweh and replacing it would definitely be violating this commandment repeatedly. So I found that a little bit funny, but trying to move on here. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days thou shalt labor and do all thy work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work, thou, nor thy son, nor thy daughter, nor thy manservant, nor thy maidservant, nor thy cattle. Somehow you have to stop your cattle from working. Nor thy stranger that is within thy gates. So you can't call a repairman in or anything. You can't do anything. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that in them is, and rested the seventh day. Wherefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. So that's the fourth commandment. Remember the Sabbath day. Keep it holy. So still, we're on much more important things than not killing, apparently, because we haven't gotten to that yet. And also, this one, he went on for three verses. He's talked so long on this one. I guess it must be the most important, you know, to rest on the seventh day. Seems kind of funny to me. All right. Sorry. Honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. The fifth commandment. Finally, we've gotten to something directed at how we should be treating each other. But this is a sort of a stupid one. Honor thy father and thy mother, because what if your parents are like crazy or nuts or something? What if they, what if they tell you to kill someone? What if they tell you to not obey the Sabbath or something like that? So it should mean honor them insofar as they are telling you to do something that you should already be doing anyway, you know, which becomes sort of useless. That's sort of a useless commandment. I mean, sure. I agree respecting your parents is important, provided you have parents who deserve respect. I mean, if your father beats you, I would say he doesn't deserve respect. So this is somehow the fifth most important possible thing to do? Is this crap commandment? Also, how does your honoring your parents contribute to longer life? It said, honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land. Like, I don't understand that part. Verse 13, thou shalt not kill, period. Finally, we've gotten to something that is pretty universally accepted. But for all the expounding that God did on the Sabbath day commandment, he couldn't take a split second to qualify this one a little bit? Like, thou shalt not kill what? Anything? Animals? Fish? Bacteria? Engines? Volleyballs? Jokes? What exactly is he talking about here? Why don't you take a minute, God? Just go ahead and... I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm not saying you're full of crap. I'm just saying, take a minute to clarify. What do you mean? What can and can't we kill? Thou shalt not commit adultery. Seventh commandment. Also, in reading about these in the notes, I found, well, not just the notes, like everything I've read, everyone takes these simple words and analyzes them to be as, like, strict as they could possibly be. Like, this one, it was, this commandment forbids all acts of uncleanliness with all those desires which produce those acts and war against the soul. That was a quote, actually, from it. No, I'm pretty sure it just says don't commit adultery. If he had meant those other things you said, he probably would have just said them. But no, it says don't commit adultery. Thou shalt not steal. Eighth commandment. Simple enough. But what if you're dying of hunger? No? No? Okay. What if someone has a nuclear bomb and they are going to kill everyone? Can you steal it? Is that okay? I mean, it's not yours. Are you allowed to steal it? Now, I know these little complaints might seem petty, and if there's any religious listening, which there aren't, I guarantee you that. If there are, they'd say, oh, this is petty crap. You're man, stupid, dumb. But I'm going to make a point with all this later. I promise, so keep that in mind. Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. Ninth commandment. Almost done. All right, this one's sort of a weird one, but it's not, you know, it's not too bad. But I love how the last four I just read were like rapid fire. You know, that God was going to great lengths about the Sabbath and all these jealousy commandments that he had that had nothing to do with morality, just BS. But then he finally gets to like the human related ones that we'd actually care about. And he's like, all right, yeah, don't kill, don't steal, yada, yada, don't do thing, whatever. Oh, you know what? I just realized. Moses, you know what's happening here? Moses is having to etch all these in stone. So he's starting to get like tired or running out of room or something. And he's like, you know, went all big with the first ones, like honor thy father and thy mother. Cause surely they are, you know, and he's like, God damn, I don't have a lot of stone left. Thou shalt not kill, period. Like, all right, where are we? Thou shalt, 10th commandment, everyone. This is the last one. You ready? Better be something good. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, nor his manservant, nor his maidservant, nor his ox, nor his ass, nor anything that is thy neighbor's. I would argue that you could have just said anything that is thy neighbor's, and that would have covered all the things you took the time to list out. So this is it, the 10th one. So we can't, this is interesting. We can't even want our neighbor's house. We can't even look at it and think, oh, man, what a good house that is. I really want that house. We can't think that? That's somehow illegal? You know, Christopher Hitchens talks about this part of it as thought crime, like a real Orwellian kind of inverse, what do they call it? Inverse utopia, reverse utopia, you know, like those 1984 Brave New World books, like thought crime, that kind of thing. And I have to say, I think I agree. It's not enough that we don't steal our neighbor's things. No, we can't even think about wanting our neighbor's things. How the hell are we supposed to stop our brain from saying, "Ooh, gosh, man, that's a good car. I want that car." Like, we can't do that. You know, I'm not going to steal it. I might just say, "That's a nice car. I want that. I wish I had that car. Kind of want it. I'm not going to steal it." Like, what's the harm in that? That just motivates you to get a better car. That's not evil. And especially coveting thy neighbor's wife. Now, I mean, all male biology is designed around coveting every possible neighbor's possible wife. I mean, that's just how it goes. So this idea that that's somehow bad is just annoying to me. I mean, sure, don't steal anything or don't take people's wives, but I mean, come on. It's your brain. Your brain thinks things, and it's not like it's your fault. Just if you act on them, that would be your fault. And all the people saw the thunderings and the lightenings and the noisenings of the trumpetings. Sorry, I'm getting a little bored with this. And the mountain smoking. And when the people saw it, they removed and stood afar off. And they said unto Moses, speak thou with us, and we will hear, but let God not speak with us, lest we die. What? So they're afraid God, if God talks to them, they'll die? Kind of weird. And Moses said unto the people, fear not, for God is come to prove you, and that his fear may be before your faces, that ye sin not. And the people stood far off. And Moses drew near unto the thick darkness where God was. And the Lord said unto Moses, thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, ye have seen that I have talked with you from heaven. Ye shall not make with me gods of silver, neither shall you make unto you gods of gold. Man, God has a jealousy problem. He's already covered this in like 2 or 3 or 4 commandments, but he has to remind him again. Again, just in case you missed it, don't make any gods out of silver. Like, is that really going to hurt him? An altar of earth thou shalt make unto me, and shalt sacrifice thereon thy burnt offerings, and thy peace offerings, thy sheep and thine oxen. In all places where I record my name, I will come unto thee, and I will bless thee. And if thou wilt make an altar of stone, thou shalt not build of hewn stone, for if thou lift up thy tool upon it, thou hast polluted it. Neither shalt thou go up by steps unto mine altar, that thy nakedness be not discovered thereon. All right, that's that. That's the end of that chapter. Now, I told you guys I was getting to a point with all these little tiny nitpicky things. Well, I would argue not so tiny, but some of them are tiny nitpicky things about these commandments. And this is something I'm going to write something about, I think. And this is that religious people, so I'm going to try to be brief to not give everything away, but religious people argue that we need God to have absolute morals. Otherwise, morals are only just whatever the most people think or whatever whoever's in power thinks. And I have seen this in debate after debate. I watch these things like crazy on YouTube. It's actually kind of a hobby of mine. I kind of like it. But anyway, that's always one of their arguments. They're absolute morals, you know, absolute morals. Everyone knows certain things are right and wrong, blah, blah, blah. And I got to say that every single when I was pointing out these little exceptions, what I was pointing out is that every single moral proclamation made in this book is in fact not absolute. Just take any of these commandments. For any one of them, I could come up with at least one and probably many more situations where it would be not the right thing to do. Take a simple one, thou shalt not kill. This is a pretty well accepted moral, but it's also very frequently abandoned. There are countless situations we could think of where the correct moral action is to kill someone. So going directly against this so-called absolute moral value. A moral value cannot be absolute if it's not absolute. If there are plenty of situations where it's wrong, then that can't be an absolute moral value. Take self-defense. There's a simple one. Now, okay, some people might argue that you shouldn't kill someone even in self-defense. That's fine. That's fine. Okay. Just raise the stakes a little more. A school bus full of young children is about to be blown up, and the only way you can stop it is to kill the person responsible. That seems like anyone here would kill the person responsible. Now, these might seem a little silly, I admit, But the point is very easily and simply made that no matter how absolute religious people try to say their morals are, they're just not. We can raise to the stakes to the point where, say, everyone on the entire earth will be killed if we don't do X. And honestly, that's not that far out of possibility. I mean, if there were enough nuclear explosives someone got a control of, it could get to that point. Now, if you fill in X, you know, with anything, anything you put in there would be the correct action when the alternative is that all of humanity will be destroyed. Think about that. I mean, if you do these little experiments, these little thought experiments, there's one conclusion that that rings very clear. There is only one absolute moral value, or I guess maybe objective would be a better word for it. And that is very simply the well-being of people. Now, I know it's not strictly utilitarianism, you know, because you can find ways to argue most good for most people. And it gets a little weird when we have to do crude calculations of saving five lives by giving up four or doing crap like that. People don't like to do that. And it makes sense. But it's very clear that this is the value behind all these little examples, because when you think of these exceptions, you know, you'd kill someone to save a bus full of children. You'd kill, you know, you'd torture someone if they had access to explosives that were going to wipe out all of civilization, all of the earth. Of course you would torture that person. What's the alternative? All of humanity is dead? Well, of course you would. You know, it's just obvious. What rings clear is that what you have in the back of your mind is the well-being of the most possible people. It's just true. I mean, you just want the best. I mean, not that it's obviously easy how to calculate that. I'm not saying it is. It's very difficult. I think there are a lot of situations where we don't know what would be best for everybody, and that's why it's difficult. But it's very clear that that's what we have in mind. And you don't need God to have that in mind. You don't need God in order to have that moral value. All you have to do is be a human. Be a person. And realize that I'm a person. There are lots of people around me who are persons. Therefore, let's do whatever is the gives the most well-being for all of us. I mean, again, it gets difficult. It's not like it's always crystal clear. But that's the truth of it. And I have many more points to say about this. I really do, actually. This is a topic I've thought a lot about, but I'll write something about that, and I'll let you know when I do. So thank you all very much. This was a long one. Sorry, but it's the Ten Commandments. That's pretty important. And,